In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about nuclear power. Not very long ago, with the past couple of months, we did a series of shows dealing with energy policy and energy issues in America. And we had on guests who were critical of nuclear generation. We wanted to have you give you the opportunity to hear from someone who would actually make the case for nuclear power. And it just took us a little while to find a guest, but we certainly did, and he is talking with us this morning. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Alan Walter. He is professor and head of nuclear engineering at Texas A&M University. He's also a past president of the American Nuclear Society, which is the largest professional organization of nuclear scientists, engineers, and educators in the world. This morning, we'll be trying to cover the bases, talk a little bit about nuclear generation, you certainly are welcome to call in if you have questions and comments. By the way, if you're interested in reading a little bit on this topic, our guest, Alan Walter, has authored a book that's titled America, the Powerless, Facing Our Nuclear Energy Dilemma. This book is published by Cogito Books. It's a paperback. It came out a few years ago. And so if you're interested in reading about it, you can certainly seek out that book. But of course, questions are welcome. Anyone who would like to call in is welcome to do that. We ask only that callers just try to keep their comments as brief as possible so that we can get in as many folks as possible. But if you'd like to call, you're certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL or 9455. That's the same either way. And also toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Professor Walter, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us today.
It's my pleasure.
I appreciate it. Back in May, when President Bush announced his energy plan, nuclear power was part of it. And one of the things that the administration said was they thought here it offered nuclear generation did offer an opportunity to generate electricity without producing air pollution. Mm-hmm. And I think that then some people after the Bush energy policy was made public, some people were saying that perhaps this could mean a resurgence for nuclear power. And of course, depending upon how one felt about that, that might either be good news or bad news. But considering that it's been such a long time since a new plant was undertaken, do you really think that indeed at this point there could be a resurgence of interest in and perhaps new nuclear plants being built?
Well, I certainly do, David. You're right that it's been a long time since we've had a new plant come online, and that's really because there haven't really been any big central station plants built over the past couple of decades. But now I think people are recognizing that the energy glut that we've really had for quite a while is about to disappear, and so we've got to look down the road. And in that sense, looking at the nuclear power option, I think makes a lot of sense. We've said, David, in this business for a long time, that the reality is that the public probably won't recognize the need for new energy sources until the lights go out. It just electricity is something we've just sort of taken for granted in our generation. But with what's happened in California, I think has been kind of a wake-up call. And so I think now perhaps the American public recognizes that it's not just business as usual. We need to look at several options, and I'm certainly not going to say that nuclear is the only way to go, but it certainly deserves to be now looked at in a new light.
Well, how, as one compares the pros and cons of different forms of energy production, mm-hmm. how do you weigh nuclear power?
Well, there are a couple of, really two or three ways, I guess. One is we have to honestly look at what the long-term picture looks like. And right now, at least in the world of electricity, over half of our electricity is generated from coal. And if you throw in oil and natural gas and so forth, it's about 70 to 75%. In other words, we're really using, we're making electricity from non-renewable sources, and I think anyone would recognize that that's not going to last forever. Now, granted, coal may last for a couple of centuries or so, oil and gas, of course, much less than that. But so over the long term, we have to do something to replace those, because energy our use of energy is going up all the time, not only in this country but around the world. So that's one factor that we have to think about. Another, then, is the environmental aspects, which you alluded to earlier. The fossil fuels generate carbon dioxide. This is something that's become an international issue now in terms of global warming. There are also other pollutants that are put in the air, like sulfur and nitrogen oxides and so forth, that are concerns for acid rain and other things. So there's the whole environmental question. And then kind of a third question would be cost. How expensive are the various forms of generating electricity? And then there are some safety considerations and so forth. So when you look at all those together, at some point we have to wean ourselves away from the non-renewables. And that certainly argues in favor of nuclear, but that also argues in favor of renewables, like the solar and those things. But then we start looking at the environmental implications as well. And as you indicated earlier, one of the things that's really very nice about a nuclear system is that it doesn't pollute the atmosphere. Now, that isn't to say that there is not some pollution generated during the whole nuclear cycle, because it does take some energy to build these things. I mean, we need materials irrespective of the kind of energy source that we build. And, if we build a nuclear power plant using electricity generated from coal, then in terms of a whole life cycle, we do have to account for the pollutants that are involved in building that. But in that same sentence, if we're talking about solar, for instance, which I think most people have this very, very nice warm feeling about, it takes materials to build a solar plant as well. In fact, a lot more materials, simply because it takes so much area to collect the solar energy. And so if we ask, is there pollution associated with solar, the answer is yes, there is, because we have to pour the concrete, we have to make glass, and huge amounts of glass, copper, and so forth. And again, if we look at all of that, the reality is that there is more pollution associated overall in a solar plant than there is a nuclear plant. And so, I mean, these are kinds of things that we don't normally think of. But it's in this context of looking down the road that we have got to do something to get away from the 70% or so of electricity that's being generated by non-renewable. Mm.
I think that in some people's minds, however, the major argument against nuclear power is the fact that generation produces high-level radioactive waste, and that now it's being stored the places that it's been generated. It's being stored at power plants. And now for a number of years, the federal government has had a project to try to develop a storage site. In fact, the enabling legislation for this was in 98. Was that? Do I have that right?
For the Yucca Mountain.
Yeah, for Yucca Mountain.
It actually started a bit earlier than that. It changes every once in a while, but that's roughly the right time frame.
Okay. So in any case, and I believe that the Bush administration this year is supposed to make a decision whether or not they're going to license this facility. Yeah. But even if it opens, there's so much waste that is waiting to go that my understanding is even if it opens, immediately it's full. So here we have a very dangerous substance that we need to store to make sure that it stays away from people and it stays out of the environment. And I guess in some people's minds, they would say, why even have a form of production that results in this highly dangerous thing that then now we've got to figure out how to store safely for a very long time?
Well, I agree, David. I think this is probably now the number one concern among the public, the waste. People talk about this being around for thousands of years, maybe 10,000 of years and so forth. I'd like to comment on that. I hope people will retain an open mind on this, because I think, number one, the amount of waste that we're talking about is very, very small. Anything that generates useful output for humanity, I don't care whether it's automobiles or the human body itself, I mean, there is waste. And so one question is how much of it is there, and then the other question is how do we deal with it? In terms of the amount of waste, it's it's just almost infinitesimal compared to other sources. For instance, if we're talking of generating electricity, as I've indicated, over 50% of our electricity now comes from coal. Well, from a coal plant generates a huge amount of waste, which is most is in fact put directly into the atmosphere. It probably generates of the order of 10,000 times as much waste as a nuclear power plant. So if we just talk about the waste issue, if right now we have about 103 nuclear power plants operating in the country, if all of the high-level waste that the public is concerned about were to be stored in one place like Yucca Mountain over the full 40-year period of these plants, the total amount of waste would cover a football field to a depth of about 5 meters. I mean, this is an incredibly small quantity when one thinks about what, because it's generating 20% of all of our electricity now. Okay, now I can just kind of hear the public saying, oh, but boy, I don't want that on my football field. But my point is, it's a very, very small amount. Now, the second question is, okay, how hazardous is it? Well, if we're talking about something that has a so-called half-life of thousands of years, I think the public sometimes thinks, oh, my goodness, this must be incredibly dangerous. But the reality is, the longer the half-life in terms of the radiation damage, if you will, or insult, the less hazardous it is. And the reality is that if we have a substance that has a radioactive half-life of a day, that means that its energy is spent, if you will, in a very, very short period of time, and the radiation release is quite intense. Whereas if it's thousands of years, it's very, very low. For instance, uranium has a very long half-life of several thousands of years, but you can hold it in your hand, the uranium that we get out of the ground. And in fact, there are substances that have infinite half-lives, not thousands of years, not hundreds of thousands of years, not millions of years, but infinity, things like arsenic and lead and so forth. But somehow they're in common commerce, but we don't worry about these, or at least I think the public doesn't worry about them, because they're familiar. We've had them for a long time. Still in all, I will confess or admit, David, that, you know, it would be nice if we didn't have to deal with this waste and keep it away from the ecosphere for a long period of time. And the fact is, there are ways to do this. The French are doing it, the British are doing it, the Japanese are starting to do it, and that's namely when the fuel comes out of the reactor, rather than just letting it set in the cooling ponds adjacent to the reactors where it is now. Some of them are in dry storage, but you're right, they're all contained within the nuclear parks around the country. Rather than then putting that directly into the ground, it's possibly to chemically reprocess that material, take out the materials that have very long half-lives, and in fact, many of those materials have an enormous amount of energy content left in them, recycle those back into new fuel. And when we do that, David, we're now talking about materials that will last of the order of maybe 200 to 400 years or something. I mean, it's a much, much more tractable situation to handle. But somehow, when one mentions recycle or reprocessing, the environmentalist, and I consider myself an environmentalist, we do this with our glass recycling, with our lawn mulching and that sort of thing, and yet when that word is used with nuclear, somehow it carries the connotation this is a bad thing to do. But what I'm saying is, technically, if this is an issue, if it's really a major issue for the public, there are technical ways to do it, and it's being done in other places of the world. We just aren't doing it here.
Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580 is Professor Alan Walter. He heads the Department of Nuclear Engineering at Texas A&M University. We're talking about nuclear power. We've been wanting to do this show for a while because we did a series of programs looking at energy issues, and we certainly heard from some people who were critical of nuclear generation, and we wanted to have another viewpoint for you to hear. And if you have questions or comments, you can certainly call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana, any place the signal will travel, and that is 800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers here. We'll start with a caller in Peoria, line number 4, right here. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Can't they reprocess these nuclear plants? Another thing, why don't they use wind and water also? Another thing is solar and thermal.
That's the I guess, Professor Walter, that I suppose some people, as the caller suggests, some people would say that really that rather than making the comparison between, say, nuclear power and another non-sustainable, non-renewable, polluting form of generation such as burning coal, that the better comparison is between nuclear power and, say, solar or wind or geothermal, something that indeed is renewable, is non-polluting, and that's really the kind of comparisons we ought to be drawing. And if you make those comparisons, then nuclear power doesn't look so good.
Well, it's a good question. I'm glad that your listener pointed this out, because you're right. If we're looking very far down the line, then coal and oil and natural gas aren't even a part of the mix. So the question is, how do we then compare them? I guess I want to make it clear right up at front. I am certainly not anti-solar, anti-geothermal. My own feeling is that we are going to need all of these, and we should be working very, very hard to develop them, at much greater effort than we're putting into it now. But I do feel like I've got to say one of the basic concerns associated with solar energy is that it's inherently a very diffuse energy source. That is, there is only so much energy that we can capture per square foot on Earth at any given time. And I think we all know that Tucson, Arizona might be perhaps the best place, but even there, there are very, very severe limitations on how much energy can be captured. If it was a high-intense energy source, we couldn't walk outside. I mean, we'd be in a microwave oven. So we know that it's a very diffuse source. And, of course, if we have cloud cover or many places in the world where we get less sunlight, the energy density goes down. And the other thing is, of course, it goes away at night. So as an absolute minimum, we never, ever could completely depend upon a solar energy system. We'd have to have a storage system because we do need to have electricity at night. But because of that very diffuse nature of solar, it requires a very, very large collection area, which intrinsically means dedicating a lot of land to do this, a huge amount of materials. And that's something that is going to always involve relatively high cost because of the cost of the land, the cost of materials. And so I think we have to recognize that there's a reason why today solar energy is making a very, very small impact in our total energy. In fact, just to put this in perspective, today about 52% comes from coal, 20% from nuclear, 15% natural gas, I think about 8% from hydro. Less than 2% of all of our electricity currently produced in the United States comes from the renewables that I think our listeners is suggesting. And it turns out that less than about like 1 to 1.5% is geothermal, only about 0.5% comes from solar. And again, the reason for that is that there has been a lot of effort put into, say, wind parks and so forth, but they require a lot of space and the efficiency is low. It's difficult to believe that we are ever going to get huge amounts of electricity from these sources unless we're willing to pay a considerably high price. It's just a fundamental question of energy density. Now, again, please don't misunderstand. I'm not saying that we shouldn't do this, but I don't think that I think it's a delusion to feel that somehow solar energy is going to solve all our problems. It simply won't unless we're willing to pay an enormous price.
All right, let's go on to a caller in Chicago, line number one. Hello.
Thank you. I'd like to ask a question about the nuclear waste. Mm-hmm. Has that situation any closer to being resolved as to terms of storage or use and danger? Are we closer to a resolution of this matter, let alone the upcoming transportation of the hazardous waste from the various places across the country, endangering in transportation accidents and so forth?
Well, you bring up a couple of good questions. One is the transportation, and one is the ultimate storage. Maybe start with transportation first. We do have to transport the materials from the nuclear parks, if you will, to a repository. Again, that's an area where, to the best of my knowledge, there's both a low-level waste that we need to worry about and high-level waste. I think the major concern here is the high-level waste. That was what you were talking about, David, earlier, that has long half-lives and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
To the best of my knowledge, there has never been an incident for that matter, in the world, where a cask containing high-level waste has ruptured and has exposed itself to the public and so forth. These casks that the material are put in have to undergo incredibly stringent requirements. You have to be able to drop these things 30 feet onto a sharp spike and that sort of thing. They have to be able to withstand being in the middle of a fire for a half hour at very high temperatures without rupturing. They have to be capable of being submerged into water for long periods of time with no problems. And I don't say this casually. I mean, there are tests that are put together. There have been tests, for instance, at Sandia National Laboratory, of taking the cask this high-level waste has put in and literally smashing these things with high-speed locomotives. I mean, just, you know, and the casks survive. So there's very, very stringent requirements. And as I said before, I'm not aware of any incident in the world where one of these high-level casks has failed. So from a transportation standpoint, there really is a very, very low risk. I would personally far prefer to ride on top of one of these casks than I would to drive a car in Chicago. And I'm really serious about that. Second thing, then, is your question about are we any nearer to the resolution of a repository. And in this country, there have been several sites that have been looked at, but the one that's being focused on now is in Nevada. It's called Yucca Mountain. By the way, it's not a mountain. I've been there. It's a ridge, but it's out in desert country. It's been something like $6 billion or so have been poured into that to characterize the site, to see if it is scientifically suitable for storage of waste that would last a long period of time. And by the way, the money to do that didn't come from the taxpayers. There's a tax on electricity generated from nuclear power, and that's what's built up this. And just as an aside, only a fraction of that has gone into this characterization of the site. A lot of it Congress just uses to cover other bills, which is a side point that I'm a little irritated about. But in any event, it has been characterized, and I understand just within the past week or so, the scientific report has been sent in to the Secretary of Energy, and that will be then looked at and then ultimately passed on to the President for a decision as to whether or not the site is suitable. And then it would go to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for their detailed evaluation and so forth. But I must say, a lot of work has already gone into this, and my own feeling here, and again, I don't say this without I don't want to be flippant here, but I really believe that the major issue is political and not technical. And you know, we there certainly have been cases where the material that is packaged to put in a repository like that have shown that they can. There are glass forms that have been have lasted for thousands of years without problem and so forth. There's a lot of data that would suggest that the risk of any of that material ever getting back into the ecosystem is very, very low. If you read in the papers, there's a lot of opposition from the state of Nevada. The senators there, the governor, and so forth are simply don't want this. And this ultimately is a very emotional situation. But as I say, technically, let me just give an example. People say that nuclear energy is something brand new we invented 50 years ago. The reality is, I think very few people know this, but there was a nuclear reactor that existed, oh my goodness, billions of years ago in South Africa. And this might be shocking to some people, but uranium does occur in the crust of the earth. That's where we get our uranium. And there's a place near Gabon, which is, I think, in western part of Africa, that had uranium, natural uranium ores that were rich enough and close enough together that a nuclear chain reaction actually occurred. It went on for thousands, tens of thousands of years.
Wow.
This was far before Homo sapien was even thought of. And of course, there were no containment whatsoever, just natural earth, if you will. And so fission products were developed. All of the things that we're talking about here that are part of high-level waste all went on there, large parts of it. And then at some point, the reactor went subcritical because it burned up the fuel and so forth. This was discovered. Scientists from Los Alamos Laboratory and other places in the world went to look at that and found that the fission products that we're worried about now getting out of a repository moved only matters of inches or feet or something like this. I mean, and there was no containment whatsoever. I mean, some of this was right near the surface of the earth. There are other examples like this where there are natural phenomena that have been studied to look at how materials move with water or through the earth. an enormous amount of scientific data that would that would suggest that, you know, what we are doing, we're not only is the natural phenomena there, but we're containing these things in special logs that are gone through a lot of testing and so forth, putting all kinds of barriers and then sinking these things you know, thousands of feet into the earth and so forth. It's from an engineering standpoint, you know, one would say this is overkill. I mean, we're just it's an incredibly you know, safety is has been uppermost in the minds of nuclear engineers since we really were born, so to speak. And so again, there are probably people out there saying, well, look, you know, you're a nuclear engineering professor. That's how you earn your living, and therefore, of course, you're going to be a zealot. But I can tell you that I have spent a lot of time personally, you know, groping with the whole issue of nuclear power and so forth, which started back when Jimmy Carter was elected, because you know, I've always had a lot of respect for him as a person, and he was one of the first to express concern about this. And the fact that he was concerned, I was concerned, and I've tried to look at all of these other implications associated with knowing, you know, we need electricity. Where are we going to get it? And when I've looked at all of this, I've come to the conclusion that sure, there are some risks involved with nuclear, but the risks are much, much higher, essentially, with any other form. And so I don't know how to get this message across other than to just ask people to look honestly at the science. And the waste problem, I really believe is fundamentally a political problem and not a technical problem.
So maybe again, this is a question that's impossible to answer, but do you think that the Yucca Mountain site will be licensed and will open?
You know, Dave, I'm not a politician. Scientists are horrible politicians. You know, at some point in time, we will have to find a place in the country to do that. I mean, we don't have to do it here. Russia, for instance, has offered to provide places to do that. But, I mean, is this really the right thing for the United States to do? I mean, I don't know. I think eventually it probably will be cited. But quite honestly, the way it's being proposed now, you talked about in 1998, this whole process of trying to find a geologic repository has gone on for years and years and years. And originally the idea was to find a site where the fuel would be reprocessed, as I had mentioned earlier, chemically reprocessed, and the fission products would go in one direction and all of the useful materials would go in another direction, would be recycled back in for fuel. And in that case, the kind of waste that is left over does not have very much heat-generating capacity in it. It doesn't have these long-lived isotopes and so forth. That was the original design. But now, since because of the political arguments that take place over a period of time, people are talking about putting spent fuel directly, that is fuel that comes out of the reactor, put it directly into the ground. And frankly, I don't personally think that's the right thing to do, because the fuel now is hotter. It has fission products generating heat, and so you know, this is part of what scientific characterization is looking at these kinds of things. But it's less of a load to the repository if we did it, you know, if we recycled, took out the energy, and then only put the very small amount of stuff that we really don't like back into the repository. And by the way, before I forget it, you know, it's kind of like my wife is one of these stops at every yard sale kind of thing. And, you know, what is one person's junk is another person's treasure. I think a lot of listeners will resonate to that. What we're calling nuclear waste today could very well be extremely valuable in the world of tomorrow. I personally have had a chance to look at some of the medical implications of so-called nuclear waste. I expect you have a lot of listeners that recognize that radiation is one of the modalities for treating cancer. There's a lot of work going on now which requires specialty isotopes to do this. And right now we're just taking this stuff and throwing it away. But as technology advances in so many other fields, we have learned how to use what the previous generation thought was waste, and we find many, many humanitarian applications. And so I kind of hate to use that word waste, because it implies a you know, refuge pile or something where there's no inherent value. And the reality is, a lot of these radioisotopes, if they were separated out, we could use them for industrial and medical purposes. We can use those, for instance, for irradiating food. I mean, this is a whole I don't know if you want to get into that, David.
Well, that may be the kind of thing we want to save for another conversation. And actually, I'm also thinking that we do. The lines are full. We have a number of other callers.
Okay, fine, all right.
And I want to try to give these folks a chance to speak. And we are also a little bit past the midpoint here, so I should introduce again our guest. We're speaking with Alan Walter. He's professor and head of nuclear engineering at Texas A&M University. And this is this conversation intended to be a part of a series that we were doing earlier this summer, talking about energy and energy policy. And we did indeed have several people make comments critical of nuclear generation, and we wanted to have somebody make the case for, and it just took us a little while to find someone to do it. And that's what we're doing here this morning. The lines are full, so we'll get right back to it, starting with our next caller in Urbana on line number 2. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Okay, I have a couple of questions. One, considering economics. We hear from the nuclear power advocates that it's now almost competitive with other forms of energy. However, the government is the one who is paying for extraction, purification, not to say who's going to dismantle the cost of dismantling these reactors when they have to be dismantling, and the storage costs. So I'd like your comments about all those things. I think when you add all those in, it's vastly more expensive than other forms of energy. Two, there's the question of proliferation. Uh-huh. And I'd like to hear your response on that. The other thing is a little bit aside, but you spoke about the diffuseness of solar energy. I would like to know if you have any firm figures on what could be done, in fact, with solar energy, firm figures on that, and that would include wind energy as well. So I'll stop there.
Okay. Well,
you got all those?
Yeah. I don't know. we'll try. Economics. One of the things that the nuclear power industry has tried to do right from the beginning is to include total life cycle costs in the cost of the of the product, which is not the case for oil, natural gas, coal, and many other forms of energy. The dismantling costs and so forth, those are all factored into the cost. I think I indicated earlier the nuclear power has been charging 1 mil per kilowatt hour, which is a tenth of a cent per kilowatt hour, for the waste disposal question, and that has generated now, I don't know, $6-8 billion or something like that. Much of what has been used to characterize the Yucca Mountain site, some has been siphoned off for other government purposes, which, I say, is, as a scientist, is somewhat irritating to me. But those costs are included. Now, just for a perspective, I think a few years ago there was a general feeling in the nuclear power business that, oh my goodness, these 100 reactors that we had were all drags, white elephants, utilities were trying to unload them and so forth. All of a sudden they realize the reactors that we have online now are the cheapest, producing the cheapest power that we have in the
Does
country.
Does that include the cost of the materials and the development of the reactors?
Well, let me just finish. I'll come back to the. I'm saying that the reactors that are currently running, we'll start with that, and then we'll take a step back.
Okay.
The reactors that are currently running last year, 1999, I guess is the latest day that I have, maybe it's a year ago, was about 1.8 cents a kilowatt hour. The next best was coal, which is about 2.1. Oil was 3.1. Gas was 3.5. So this, from just taking where the utilities are right now, the nuclear power plants are real moneymakers, and this is why there are utilities that are really in the business, so to speak, are snapping up nuclear reactors from the smaller utilities because they've got the management team to run these. And by the way, I would say it does take a competent management team to do this. I mean, this is not something these are not tinker toys. It does require a very solid backlog. Now, having said all that,
yes.
The question then is, how about building new nuclear power plants? And frankly, the nemesis of the nuclear power business has really been in the cost of the new plants. And this is why utilities have been slow to buy new plants, because once they have them operating, they're moneymakers. They beat the competition, all the competition. But they are expensive to build. Now, fortunately, in the last 20 years, where there have not been new orders of nuclear power plants, the vendors haven't been asleep in the national laboratories. They've come up with new designs that on paper, and I have to emphasize, yes, they are on paper, look like they would be very, very competitive to build. because they're now talking about, rather than building huge plants, small modular units that can use a lot of factory fabrication and so forth, there is one particular plant that's being built in South Africa called the Pebble Bed Reactor that is causing a lot of interest in this country because it can be built in small modules, has an incredible safety characteristics, and from an economic standpoint, looks like it could be competitive as built. I don't know yet. It's probably a couple of years away before we really know that. But I guess the bottom line on the economics are the ones that are running now, there isn't any question, they're the most successful and save the ratepayers the most money of any form of generating electricity. There is still a question about buying the new plants. You know, can the industry deliver the new plants that will meet the design on paper? And, one never really knows till you build them, but they do look very attractive.
Do the plants actually buy the nuclear fuel?
The utilities, it's a commercial business. The utilities buy the fuel. The uranium that is enriched does go through the government enrichment plants, but even that has been privatized now. There's hopefully come to me. There's a new corporation that is doing that. In fact, there is some uranium that's even coming from Russia that's being blended into fuel for plants. But the utilities pay the price. I mean, they buy the fuel. It's millions of dollars it costs for their fuel. So it's not a government subsidy. On the proliferation question, I'm glad you brought that up because that is in fact the issue. And I mentioned earlier that President Carter stopped the recycle reprocessing plan, which most nuclear engineers, in fact, I think say essentially all, feel that technically is the right way to go. And the reason he stopped it was because in the process of chemically separating the spent nuclear fuel, the idea is to pull out the good fuel, if you will, and put it back in for new fuel for another reactor, or put it back in the reactor, and then take away the, quote, waste, the stuff that at least today we don't know what to do with, and bury that in a repository. His concern was, during that chemical separation process, that plutonium, which is one of the byproducts in a reactor, plutonium would be separated into a relatively pure form, which a rogue nation or group of terrorists then could use to build nuclear weapons. Well, it turns out technically, theoretically, that could be done. And there was a big study that was done, international study, to see if there was any way to completely block that path. Well, it turns out technically there wasn't any completely way to block that path, so it was a concern. On the other hand, no country that has acquired nuclear weapons has ever used that route to get it, because the fuel, the quality of the plutonium that comes from that plant, although theoretically could be used in a nuclear weapon, is the last kind of stuff that would want to use, because it has a lot of impurities in it. It really compromises the electronics and other issues that I can't get into in a public forum, because there are some very sensitive things about, you know, that design. But the point is that is not a way that anybody would want to do this. In fact, India and Pakistan used research reactors to get the material that they're putting in their weapons. No nation or entity that I'm aware of has ever used this route of trying to get used fuel, if you will, or extract the materials from used fuel. It's technically possible, but it's bad stuff. It's tough stuff to work with. But now, having said all that, are there ways that we can improve upon that? And the answer is yes. The Department of Energy has underway a new type of program called Generation 4 reactors, where they're really emphasizing the fuel cycle to make it as robust as possible in terms of the proliferation resistance question. And in fact, since you're in the Chicago area, you might appreciate the fact that Argonne National Laboratory, which is just west of Chicago, has been the world leader in developing a new fuel cycle where, in contrary to trying to separate the plutonium from the fission products, which is what we wanted to do earlier, that process makes that impossible. The fission products and the plutonium stay together, so the fuel is always hardened. That is, it's essentially impossible to use that fuel in a weapon, and yet that can be put back into the reactor, and it'll burn very well. This is an exciting development, and in fact, David, to go back to your opener here, that was specifically mentioned in the President's Energy Plan, which came out in May. It's called the IFR, the Integral Fuel Cycle Reactor. So there are ways, technology keeps moving along, and so at this point in time, we're feeling that some of these technologies are allowed to be used in the new generation reactors. We even have a higher degree of confidence that we don't need to be concerned about proliferation.
We're going into our last 10 minutes here, and I want to jump in and again go on to another caller.
Okay.
And so I hope the caller will forgive me and say, let's leave the solar question, since you're really not a solar guy. Maybe we can talk about some more about solar on another day. But I want to sort of stick a little bit more with what we're doing here.
Okay.
And again, let me introduce our guest. We're speaking with Alan Walter. He's professor and head of nuclear engineering at Texas A&M University. The next caller is Champaign County. We'll go right there, line 3. Hello.
Hi. I try and be brief, and this isn't in the form of a question, but I'm sure the guests will have some reactions. Just in the news today, Exelon runs the plant that's upwind of Champaign County. It's in Champaign. Clinton was scolded for, reprimanded, I guess is a better word, mildly, apparently, by the NRC for failing to introduce training for staff, even though they were reprimanded earlier when the NRC tested them and found that, I think, 75% of the staff failed competency tests. Exelon is the same company that's investing in the South African reactor you just talked about.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, they are lobbying for an extension of the Price-Anderson Act, which is the part of the economics, the liability part, that you didn't discuss yet. They're spending lots of money on that, but they're not putting the money into the training, apparently, because they've just been reprimanded. It is really outrageous. We have another news item with this train on fire for 36 hours in the tunnel under Baltimore. If that had also had a nuclear cask on it, the temperature in that tunnel went up 25 degrees higher or 50 degrees higher than what those casks are rated for. There are a lot of ignored dangers that you seem to be able to dismiss out of hand. And speaking of dismissing out of the hand, the Bush administration has dismissed the appeals for treatment from nuclear workers. Now, just that was a news item from yesterday. This was not people that were specifically in the production of nuclear fuel. They were actually from the nuclear bomb program more. But it's still a denial of this kind of taking responsibility for the externalities of these processes. As far as this is in compensation for all of the energy discussion that was anti-nuclear, at least one of those energy advocates or energy discussants was an advocate of nuclear power, and I hope that this doesn't, supposedly settle the issue. I don't know that a representative from the Nuclear Information Research Service in Evanston has been on, at least in the last year, at least not as part of this series. As far as the diffuseness of solar energy, which was rendered off limits, so is a lot of electricity usage, and I think a lot of the lack of investment in that kind of energy solution is just because it can't be centralized. Consequently, large companies like Exelon, et cetera, can't control the spigot. So there are a lot of things going on here, and it's much more complicated than I think. This is a radio show, so I have to speak in some generalities. I've had my say, and I'll let that go out over the ether, and I'll listen to the last couple.
All right. Well, the caller certainly has raised a number of points. Professor Walter, you deal with any that you would like.
Well, I'm not familiar. Excuse me, I'm not familiar with the recent incident that he's talking about, the Clinton plant. And so I'm just not in a position to really comment. I do know, though, that the NRC does have enormous credibility, not only here and abroad, and the utilities, as far as I know, have been listening very, very carefully. So if there's something that's really serious here, I can't believe that Exelon won't respond. I just can't, I can't deal with the issue because I don't know it. I do know, however, that the NRC has changed its approach somewhat from a prescriptive type of licensing approach to more of a risk-based kind of thing, and therefore they're giving goals, if you will, or standards to the utilities, not telling them how to do it, but letting them do this. And I think this is the best thing that one brings out the entrepreneurship, if you will, of the Americans here to do that. And in fact, that's resulted in better safety and lower costs at the same time. People were concerned for a while that safety would be compromised. In fact, it's actually improved. The plant performances now have across the country are exceptionally good. In fact, that's why the price has come down. No new nuclear reactors have come online for quite a while, but in the past 10 years, the equivalent of something like 23 new plants, the energy is there simply because they're operating more efficiently. Golly, I can't remember all of the concerns here. I'm certainly not going to suggest to the caller in here or anyone else that there are no risks associated with the nuclear. That's just not true. There are risks in everything. But I think what we have to do, in fact, I would strongly urge all of us to do, is to say compared to what? The question about solar being maybe not supported by the large industry because it can't be centralized, let's just kind of assume what would happen if we all had to deal with our own generation of electricity. We had to go up onto our roofs and adjust our solar panels and so forth. It's just kind of mind-boggling in terms of the kinds of energies, injuries, electrocution, and so forth that would result for that if we really went that route. I'm not sure that the public really wants to have responsibility to do that. It may be that some sectors want to do that, and certainly that's fine. Not opposed to it, but we simply can't get away from the fact that solar is a diffuse energy source, and so that's going to always make the cost high. I might just comment. Some of you might have known of the Meynells at the University of Arizona, who the Sierra Club looked at as the solar zealots for many years. And I heard Arden give a talk a few years ago who said, 20 years ago I said that solar was the energy of the future. 10 years ago I said solar was the energy of the future. And today I stand here and tell you solar is the energy of the future. It will always be the energy of the future. His point being that this cost question is always going to be there. Now, at some point, if the American people want to pay the extra cost, so be it. But we can't delude ourselves into thinking that that's going to solve all of our problems and that there are no hazards associated with it, because there really are. Should we talk about some of these other things, Dave?
Well, we're getting to the point where we about have a minute left, so I think probably we're going to have to leave it there. And my apologies, we have some callers that we can't take, but I'm certain that this won't be the last time we ever discuss this on the program. But for the moment, I think we're going to have to leave it at that and say to you, Professor Walter, thanks very much for giving us some of your time today.
Well, okay, and I might just say, I don't want to plug the book per se, but I do think that the reason for putting that together was to try to deal with some of these issues, because an hour on a talk show just doesn't do it. And I won't claim to have all the answers, please understand. But I really believe that when we look at the total picture, that we've got to be open to a power source that can be, in fact, is economic, is environmentally friendly, and is safe, and compare this to other sources in making these decisions.
Okay, and the book is America the Powerless, Facing Our Nuclear Energy Dilemma, by our guest Alan Walter, published by Cogito Books, and thanks very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Our guest Alan Walter, professor, head of nuclear engineering at Texas A&M University.